Yeah, so Matthew's really was the person who got in the lab, rolled up his sleeves, and collected data on the first site-directed mutant. In that lab, they developed an efficient method of collecting X-ray data with film, X-ray film. And it's an old technology that they had raised to a new plane. But as a result, I wasn't at all familiar with it, so I didn't know what to do. I mean, I could grow the crystal, but I couldn't take the data. So, you know, it was really Brian who said, okay, this is happening. Let's figure out how to make the structure determination go well. And so he went in and collected the first set of data and figured out that sort of process of determining the structures could be streamlined.
Could you, I mean, I think of all the technical things I can keep bugging you to go into more detail about. I mean, you said we basically got it down to a situation where it's like doing an assay, getting the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that seems to me interesting in and of itself. And if you could, is there, was that, I mean, was it you, only something I'd have to go ask Matthews, that sort of thing? Or
no, what do you mean? I mean, why is it an assay, or what happened?
Why is it so, because the mutations are so close, and you can kind of just, I guess I'm getting the sense that to crystallize anything and get a picture of it requires, you know, months, 2 years of work, and that I think what you were trying to say was that because these mutants were related in the sense of their production and that sort of thing, that once you had gotten a structure for one and sort of figured out how to image it and that sort of thing, that the next one was easier and the next one, and pretty soon it was...
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these things are steps that used to be considered difficult. My graduate work, for example, after my graduate work, I used to be introduced as someone who, when I would give a talk, like someone who determine the crystal structure of a protein, determine the crystal structure of a productive ES complex, and sequence the gene. And all those things were considered hard and might be the topic of an individual thesis, right? And so people go, oh, gee, it's possible to do all these things, you know? And so the postdoc was sort of the same way. You know, determining a crystal structure, when you got the answer, you normally published a paper, whereas the attitude we were taking is, look, we want to compare 10 crystal structures or 20 crystal structures and publish one paper about a comparison of all these things. And, you know, it used to be something that people thought of as, you know, you had to talk to God or something, or you had to be an expert, and then it would still take months or years or whatever to accomplish. And basically we got it to a point where a first-year graduate student in a two-month stint in the lab could, you know, make a mutation, collect X-ray data, determine the structure, and refine the structure. Whereas before, each of these steps in labs where it hadn't been done before might have been considered a difficult thing to do.
And is this part of it, this paper, where actually it's Sundell Pin that you said was this paper that you said 80, you said 87, so I'm picking this one, but...
No, it's a Nature paper.
It is the Nature paper, okay. And not a combination of the two. I mean, this is, I realize you're not first author on this, so that it's...
No, the other paper was, it was a study in which we had all the mutants made for other purposes.
Oh, okay.
And so it was a paper where we had cysteines introduced in different parts of the protein, and they were all made for different reasons. But it turns out cysteine is a target of mercury, and that's commonly used to make heavy atom derivatives for structure determination.
Okay.
So it was, you know, falling off a log to take these proteins that had already been purified and already been crystallized and add mercury and take a few X-ray photographs and write a paper about which ones worked.
Follow this thing about the isomorphous replacement and whether you could improve upon it or had found a more systematic way.
Yeah, I mean, the question in that paper was, if you have to make a mutation to make a heavy atom derivative, where should you put the mutation?
Okay. Okay.
But anyway, so the sort of program in Oregon that developed was pick sites that have well-defined questions associated with them and make a series of mutation that tests each possibility or that you can use to quantify each interaction at that site. So the Nature paper was really the first example of that. And there's an ironic story, and that is that the first mutation, or the reason we focused on that site, is that there was a mutation in Streisinger's collection in which threonine-157 had been changed, and in fact they thought it was changed to alanine. And the evidence for that was one of these experiments where they purified the protein and took a month and chopped it up and found the piece that was different and got the amino acid composition of the piece, but it turned out it wasn't that clear, but they thought it was alanine that was different. And then it turned out that the X-ray diffraction data sort of fit with alanine, but there were always some water molecules in the model that moved a little bit too close to the methyl group of the alanine side chain, and so it was very uncomfortable. Anyway, we thought it was alanine. So threonine alanine, we thought, well, we want to find out what parts of the threonine group are leading to the change in stability. So we made a bunch of mutations there. And what happened was it turned out that we made, because of the way we made the DNA, we ended up remaking the threonine to alanine change and showed that its properties were actually different from the original mutation. And so this happened, it turned out, a week before I was scheduled to go give a job talk and all things in Seattle at the Hutch. And, you know, it really became important to find out what this mutation really was. So I went back to the original phage stock and crossed out the mutation into a background in which we could actually make and clone the T4 DNA. So the problem with phage T4 is that the DNA is modified, so it can't be cut with restriction enzymes. And so you have to do some special things to be able to handle the DNA in a conventional way.
Okay.
So we did that. I cloned it out and sequenced it, and sure enough found that it was really isoleucine that was there in the original phage stock. But fortunately, this didn't at all sort of destroy the
It sort of maybe confirmed
the experiment that we had done, or it didn't like take the mutations we'd made and make them irrelevant. In fact, it made them more interesting. The only problem was that I'd been working essentially nonstop for a week. And I went to this talk in Seattle, and I could barely stay awake. It was really awful. That was like the worst talk I've ever given.
Mm-hmm.
And God, it was really bad.
I take it it was one of these situations where you kind of get up, you have slides, and you don't read from a text, sort of.
Oh no, you don't read from a text.
Right, it's just considered absolutely like. Actually, I haven't asked anybody this yet, but why? It's just boorish, or it means you're not very bright and you don't know your work, or why does nobody read from a prepared text?
It's not considered spontaneous or
okay, but it's all those slides are mnemonic devices, right?
Sure, yeah.
And it's memorized. Or, yeah. Well, I'm sure some people, yes, put it together differently each time.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
And in some talks, people interrupt, as you go along and ask questions as you go along. It makes the talk less accessible, I think.
To do from
to read it, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was maybe kind of a performance thing too. You know, the best and the brightest, and that you're good at this. You know it because you don't need a text. But I guess okay.
I don't know.
I come from a world where people read from prepared text all the time.
Yeah,
I wouldn't go near a talk without a prepared text. At least notes to a prepared.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought it was interesting.
This talk in Seattle was amazing because turned out there was a blizzard in Seattle that day, and the city shut down, and I got to the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Institute, and nobody could get there. And instead of, you know, sending me home and getting me back another week or another month, they said, oh, just give your talk, you know.
There was three people.
And literally, there were six people in this huge room. And I really discovered in that talk what you get from the audience. You know, when you look around an audience, you get a lot of energy. And when you look and you see they're understanding or they're excited or you've said something that's piqued their interest, you can look at people and that comes right back and really adds to your enthusiasm.
Or you can look out and see, you know, even in a large group.
If somebody's sleeping, then you know you better pick up the pace or say something or try to be more interesting or do something, you know, be more provocative.
It's an interactive thing and not a...
Yeah, whereas when there were six people scattered around this room and I could barely stay awake because I hadn't slept in a week, it was terrible. Anyway, I mean, there were better things to come in all this, for sure. But, you know, I think the real process that was going on in the lab was trying to put all the pieces together. You know, for example, people in the Matthews lab really hadn't done any cloning and hadn't done much genetics, and so to get that all working and then to get the crystallography so that it was streamlined and so that people could actually do it in a reasonable amount of time. And like just even the expression of T4 lysozyme, if it takes you a month to purify the protein, you know, you can't do 20 structures, can't determine 20 structures because you'll never get the material. So just having an expression vector that made so much of the protein that you could purify in 2 days, you know, made it a huge difference.
And that was us all kind of like already understandable to you. I mean, in other words, what you kind of brought with you was, well, of course we're going to do it this, you know, because you'd already sequenced. I mean, you had enough of a sense of what was out there to be able to make these.
Well, just the sequencing
changes
part is what I had done, but, you know, and I was aware that other people had expressed proteins at high levels, you know, and David Muchmore and Rick Dahlquist's lab had done that with T4 lysozyme for us, but it wasn't that there was another lab out there, making proteins by the dozen and trying to do physical measurements.
They were all kind of figuring this out. Now, and my question is, now, is this, all this stuff and all this kind of like turning structure making into an assay, if I can kind of use the, maybe what's a little bit of a simplified.
No, that's a perfect, that's
great. Okay, yeah, you picked it.
Yeah, that's fine.
Is this transferable now to another situation? Can you pick up the next protein and do this and turn it out as quickly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Why aren't people? I don't get the sense, as you said, and as you said to me, you know, it's still publishable if you get a structure. You publish it in Science or Nature. I mean, you don't just publish it in, you know, Methods in Entomology, or I guess that's not where you publish it anyway, or Biochem. I mean, it's big news. And some of it really, I mean, and I suppose some of it is, some of the structures they get, I guess this actomyosin complex that was just published in Science, you know, I guess it was really thought to be difficult and hard, and boom,
it was incredibly
hard.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, because it's an interactive kind of, I mean, between two.
I mean, the structures that we were determining, the structures of lysozyme, you know, they're now over 500 of different mutants.
Right.
Huge number. So when I got to the lab, to Brian's lab, there were maybe 5, and when I left, there were maybe 50, and now they're 500. So it's really taking off that
way. So it really does have maybe something to do with of an area being worked well enough and...
No, what I'm going to say is that once you determine one, it becomes much easier to do.
So that first one's still a toughie.
First one's still hard.
Okay,
yeah. And this idea that the structure... Crystal structure is not an end in itself. It's the beginning. It's an assay. It's a piece of information. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an altar.
No, right, right.
Right? I mean, that's something that's, you know, in retrospect, it's something right out of Petzko's lab, right? He had a postdoc that determined the crystal structure of ribonuclease at 10 different temperatures or 6 different temperatures, you know, over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's an assay.
Right.
It's an assay, stupid. I mean, if you read this paper I gave you that we just submitted to Science.
Yeah, I mean,
I really like, one of the things I like about that paper is that it's a paper about a crystal structure, in a way, but not really. I mean, we don't say, in the text of that paper, we don't say anything about how the crystal structure was determined. It's buried in the notes.
Right, and you know. Again, it's this, but to, and now that we've discussed this really explicitly, but I was going to ask you this question, I mean, it's, this is about doing the mutants and getting a, I mean, and now we've, I don't know how many, I really won't guess how many you did, but.
There's only one in there. Okay, but it turns out it's
interesting. Oh, I thought you had done that. You'd gotten the results where you had. Oh, you didn't maybe crystallize them all, but you could tell. I mean, you could extrapolate and say that there has to be a dimer and then a trimer. Okay.
Yeah, but this is a mutant of the leucine zipper that turns out to be quite different from the leucine zipper. And instead of having two chains, it has four chains.
Right, and then it has like.
So that's why having one mutant is interesting. But the paper itself is a comparison of nine or so.
Yeah, right. And you guys were able to, you know, the two labs, three labs, maybe, no, two labs.
Yeah.
Were able to get structural data on this if you haven't crystallized it all, right?
Yeah, on the four-stranded structure, we have determined the structure.
So how many structures do you have of leucine zipper mutants from the yeast do you have? I mean, made, if you will.
Well,
between you guys.
6 or 7 now.
So that's pretty quick. I mean, when did the science piece come out when you did the
91,
first?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not even 2 years.
Yeah, but, you see, the thing is, the focus of my lab is not mutants of the leucine zipper. I mean, I have a grant to work on mutants of the leucine zipper, and we're working on mutants of the leucine zipper. But, you know, the idea of making point mutations, like single amino acid changes, and crystals that are essentially exactly the same as the wild type,
mm-hmm.
and determining the structures, and determining the stabilities, and drawing conclusions, I mean, that's exactly what Brian Matthews' lab is doing fantastically well.
With
T4 lysozyme, right? They've got 500 structures, and I've got 5 or 7 or whatever in my lab, right? So why bother? You know,
you're really right. You're going to be. This is the. Don't. Why do it again? Why do it twice? Why
do it twice? Run? Exactly. And so, you know, there are very specific issues that we're going after with these structures. And,
oh yeah. Okay.
And one of the things that's you know quite different here is that by accident, Per Harbury and Peter Kim's lab discovered that when you change the interface of a coil, you change the number of strands in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he made these peptides, crystallized them, and we determined the structure that's described in this latest paper. And the shocking thing was that this peptide made a tetramer instead of a dimer. We had no idea, right, that this was going to happen. And then Per went back and looked in solution at all his other peptides, and he found dimers, and he found trimers, and he found tetramers, he found mixtures of these different states. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, he'd opened up a whole new area,
new even problem.
Yeah. So, we can come to that.
Yeah, no, 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 later, I was just making a parallel, and just in the sense that, again, not that you were going to go out and repeat, you know, point mutations or site, you know, directed mutagenesis on this because, well, it worked once and you got, you know, but just that, again, here was a situation where, yes, the question about structural, I mean, or deriving structures to make, things clear had again, that was the point, if there was, you know, to go move on to not to publish this thing in Science and then go, ooh, we did it. You know,
yeah.
We got this structure.
Well, you know, my feeling is we need the structures to interpret data about stabilities. Mm-hmm. You just need to do it. There isn't a, but we're not going to go out systematically and try to determine 500 structures and catch up to the Matthews group. And it's just essentially redundant information. I mean, what are we going to find out that they haven't already found out, or that you couldn't find out by just looking at their data in the database?
Yeah. Right, and you think you could do that to any of them, you know, any kind of basic, I mean, any kind of protein, right? And you'll
do it. People are doing it.
Okay.
You know, now that
do you think people are going to do it to the leucine zipper also? I mean, they're going to do 200 maybe or 150 to make the point, or?
I don't know.
Okay, you're certainly not going to. I don't care. Right.
Right. I mean, okay. People are taking other proteins, studying the effects of mutations on stability. Alan Fair's group, for example, in Cambridge, is working on a protein called Barnase, and they take techniques that have been, you know, developed in other labs and just apply them.
Do you think that they're going to come up with anomalies or things that kind of finally, I mean, is it some notion that the field, I mean, is still like,
well, you have to
what happened originally with the myoglobin? Well, if we got one, now we'll get two, and maybe that'll give us this kind of rules. Now we'll do three, and maybe we'll do 50. And
well, you want to find out how general things are. It's important to find out how general things are, but.
Not on your time or so. I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, I feel that's the way I feel. Not on,
because
you know, it's not what I would prefer to focus on if I have a better idea. And as long as I have a better idea, I would prefer not to find out how general somebody else's results are. That's one of the questions, you know, is this attitude, right? Is this attitude compatible with the style of science that happens at a place like Berkeley, where you have to turn things out at a certain rate, and you know the standards are different.
Well, you've got tenure.
Well, it doesn't mean
your lab still runs and you get money and that sort of
that's
thing.
Right.
But, you know, you've always got a job in the UC system, unless you shoot someone in the head or something like with a pistol. But I would have actually wanted to, and maybe this isn't where you want to go, you can tell me, you know, I would answer that question now, but I would have suggested that you don't find the generalizing of something you've already worked quite, you know, centrally in as something you want to do, because there are still more questions about, for instance, protein stability or thermostability in proteins that require answering, and you've got some ideas on how to answer them, so you're going to go do those now. I mean, it's not like you're going to just, because you've got attitude, and you were, you know, one of the first ones, because you were involved in the lab that did it, so let's go do something else now that's...
Well, part of it is, you know, just constitutionally preferring to try something new. The other part of it is, has to do with funding. I mean, funding and credit, you know, in science now, there's no way that somebody would fund my lab to work on mutants of lysozyme, you know, point mutants of lysozyme. If we have, you know, sort of a different idea or a different approach or a whole new class of things we're going to develop, yeah, maybe we could use lysozyme. But, you know, I'm not going to be viewed as an original scientist or a creative scientist by continuing to do exactly what's happening in Brian Matthews' lab. Mm-hmm. And
although even if a lot of what that was, you know, clearly stuff that your name is on as first author. I mean, I understand
that
you didn't
fine.
Take it with you. I mean, you didn't. I mean, your projects at Utah certainly were not like just, I mean, there were certainly some things about finishing up where you are, you know, where it's the same group of people or, you know,
yeah,
from Oregon writing, but and publishing.
Well, the things that we worked on lysozyme at Utah were some business about the kinetics of protein folding that the group in Oregon is not interested in. They're focused on thermodynamic method, so you know, doing a survey of kinetic effects was, you know, easy to do, and well, it wasn't easy to do. Julie Clem did a really good job on that, but it was something that was outside the out of the tent, so to speak. Right. You know, the Oregon tent. The second thing was looking at the effects of making cavities in proteins and trying to bind ligands inside cavities. And this was something that we could just never get to work in my lab, that Brian's lab eventually got to work, and they're making a lot of hay. They're making a lot of hay about this on T4. Yeah, we tried with T4, and we just couldn't get the experiments to work.
You just always stuck with the T4.
Well, we could. We also tried with BPTI, a trypsin inhibitor.
Right.
And it was just a matter of picking the wrong ligands, really, to try to bind. That we picked things that were sticky and reactive and hard to handle. And Brian's group picked benzene, which is inert, and found that they could stick it into a cavity pretty easily. Yeah.
So you dropped that, I mean, because they figured...
Oh, yeah, they figured it out. Yeah, so I don't work on that.
Was there a suggestion that there was competition, or was that... It was kind of like, you know, I'm doing it this way, you're doing it that way, let's see, you know, what... Let's just get the answer to this question. And was there collaboration even... sharing of ideas and information?
Well, it was something that I had spoken with Brian about before I left Oregon, and you know, he said, "Yeah, try it."
Yeah.
And when we didn't make any progress, and they felt they had a way to do it, they did it. Yeah.
So there was no on either side any kind of. Some people have told me of experience of difficulty or a lot of negotiation going into the. Which project am I taking away from your lab that they have with their mentor? And other people, it's just so obvious what they're going to take away, and nobody cares. You know, so I was curious as to whether there was a negotiation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talked about it, and this is one of the things we talked about, and I just couldn't get it to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't... Mm-hmm. You have an idea. You don't, like...
Yeah.
You don't, like, pee in the post and nobody can... That's my attitude, and ideas are cheap, you know. I mean, some people have one idea, and if it's stolen and they get scooped, their career is over. But, you know, when I get to that point, I might as well hang it up anyway.
I guess that's where I would, I mean, you'd like to kind of develop this into what you did in more detail. I mean, not what didn't work, but, you know, you said Julie Clem did a really good job in that. Do you just want to kind of pick up this thread of your research and in your own lab now? Is there a whole bunch more you need to discuss about Oregon in the sense of work done there? Or can we maybe, with the other way would be to pick it up as this
this review in the sense of, I mean, because that to me is like where all these ideas, you say ideas are come cheap, right? It's the execution of them, and it seems that there's a what you're suggesting in the review, you know, there's just millions of ideas that need to be, you know...
Tested.
Yeah.
And it's almost a map of what you think you could possibly do in maybe 100 other labs, right, over the next 5 or 10 years. So I don't know how you want to...
Yeah, okay, so...
I didn't mean to cut short the work, you know, the actual postdoc
thing. Oh, yeah, no, it's boring.
Okay.
What to say?
I mean, I got a slew of questions about the review, if you want, or I can ask you about this Julie Clem thing and the Utah setting up a lab stuff. If you want,
we'll come to that.
Yeah, okay.
So Oregon.
Yeah,
I would say one thing about Oregon that we haven't touched on at all is sort of how to organize science in general, and Oregon happens to be a very cooperative, communal kind of place. People, there's a common kitchen, people share equipment, people get along, people work together, people don't get along, people work together.
It was a big, I mean, you talked about all these labs kind of working together, so it sounds like a huge sort of...
It's not huge, but it is a group of people from different departments called the Institute of Molecular Biology. And it was sort of the opposite of MIT, where in that sense. MIT sort of people had their own empires, they had their own everything, you know, their own centrifuges.
Their own kitchens, their own...
Well, there was you know, yeah, an autoclave that people shared, but, you know, people call these things empires, and you know, you would go from...
We call them fiefdoms, and...
one part of a building to another. Yeah, really. But, you know, you go from one part of a building to another, and there'd be, you know, a different king. Not very many queens, you know, in every little part of the building.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the model in Eugene was much more cooperative, much more efficient use of equipment. Excuse me.
Yeah. All right, it's back on. You were saying how it was more cooperative. There weren't so many, I guess, kings or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think as a result too, there was a lot more interchange of ideas, and what can I say? I guess I think that's a better way to organize.
And this was a kind of conscious model on the part of the MBI. Is that what it's called? That Institute of Molecular Biology, IBM, or
Institute
MBA
of Molecular
MBI.
Biology. Yeah, the people that started it that way.
And who they were, like Matthews and at
Brian
all.
Brian wasn't one of the original people. Aaron Novick, Streisinger, Frank Stahl, some of the original people.
Okay.
Sid Bernhard. But you know, I guess this gets back to the issue of there are different places that have different styles and different people do well in different environments. You know, I can imagine people who would just go nuts if they had to share their equipment and sign up and wait and not have it already there and waiting for immediate use.
Right, even
know,
if they only use
like
it
that.
1 month of the year,
yeah,
or something.
Exactly.
That's inefficient or something.
Right.
Have to wait or
right.
something. Whereas perhaps it's inefficient to have like 25 of them all use 1 month of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, so it was a, you know, very stimulating sort of place because there was a lot of scientific interaction there.
And is that, was that also maybe kind of formalized with, like, larger group meetings? I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah, sure, we had joint group meetings.
The...
And like any place, we had seminars and... That was actually something that I got involved in with two other postdocs. I helped run the seminar series for a couple of years in Eugene.
Who were the other? I mean, just for their names. And
Molly Schmidt and David Grunwald.
Okay. So not people you were necessarily collaborating with. And,
no,
it was
not
big
at all.
Enough situation.
They were postdocs in other labs.
Right. Right. Okay. And so they were. It sounds like maybe they were what? 10.
I'd have to count,
yeah.
Maybe a dozen, something like
okay,
that.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just
10 or a dozen. It wasn't huge at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the neat things about moving to Utah is that, by comparison, it was huge. You know, 90 or something instead of 10 or 15.
You mean kind of PIs in molecular biology /
right.
biochem
right.
/ micro.
Right, right. Energy level is way up.
Yeah. There wasn't a year of lull, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess maybe before we do move the you because you had, I think kind of picked the well we can also did you look at your I mean if you wanted to maybe kind of
well you wanted
now.
To talk about the review
yeah but we can pick that up tomorrow if that's going to be a better situation for you or
well I think we could talk about it during my last year there virtually all I did was write. And so I was writing up a lot of catching up.
87 and 88, right.
Yeah. Petsco had suggested to the editors of Annual Review of Biochemistry that they asked me to write a review on protein stability. And specifically, what have we learned from mutations? And at the time... you know, I was feeling basically that all we had to do to understand protein stability was make enough mutations at carefully chosen sites where you could isolate different effects, do careful characterizations and comparisons, and basically we would understand how to then look at a structure or analyze a structure mm-hmm. and quantitatively determine specific interactions were contributing to stabilizing that structure.
Right.
And that was an article of faith, essentially, you know, that...
And that's what maybe kept you going through all this.
Yeah, just make enough mutations, you know.
This is a new method, right?
You know, we've never had this kind of information before, and we just have to collect enough of it, find enough correlations, for example, between destabilization and dynamics calculations or something, you know, and then
plot it, and then you'll get some mathematical formulas out of it, and you can just plug it all in from now on, or something like that.
Right, exactly. You'd take the T4 lysozyme mutations and then analyze them and then apply them generally.
You just have to do one mutation, right? And you get the two, the X and the Y, and it was simple algebra.
Exactly. And so that was the underlying attitude that I took to that review. And the other major thing I wanted to point out in the review was that the field's view of protein stability was derived mostly from studies of much simpler model systems. So guanidinium acetate to study ion pairs. And
that was kind of like the model of the electrical ion or charge, you know,
exactly.
role in stability or instability.
Yeah. And methylacetamide to study hydrogen bonds, and solvent transfer experiments to study the hydrophobic effect. And what I wanted to say in this review is, we think of protein stability because of all these studies of model systems where people use really simple compounds to isolate interactions and measure how strong they are. Now you can do that with a protein. By the way, now you can do that with a protein. And let's see how the results with proteins compare with the results from these model systems. And the obvious thing is that they don't compare.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the basic assumption of a model system is that every interaction of that type contributes that amount, and you just count the number of interactions mm-hmm. and then multiply it by the scalar amount of contribution, and you get, okay. But what we found in modifying proteins was that, you know, different hydrogen bonds, when you interrupted them or disrupted them with mutations, you got different effects on the stability and the structure of the protein.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately sort of blows away the basic premise of using model systems. And I sort of wanted to say that without being hostile to mm-hmm. all this classic work, but just to talk about what are the differences. And I would say that the most important sort of finding in my graduate work really was this study that was published in Biochemistry in 1987, mm-hmm. where we finally streamlined the methods of cloning out T4 DNA, phage DNA. And Julie Nye, who was to become my wife.
Okay, this is a giant okay.
Slipping this in here. Was an undergraduate who, you know, was assigned this sort of...
An undergraduate, you said?
Yeah, okay. She was an undergraduate. She was assigned this sort of tedious back burner project of characterizing all these mutations in Streisinger's collection. And to do that, we just got really serious about all the phage crosses and standardized everything and got the vectors set up so that you could do a single restriction digest and clone the gene, and we had the primers made so you could sequence a whole gene all at once. Excuse me.
Yeah. And you were talking about how you, this was the kind of a project being set to your future wife, but you know, but that made you get on the horse and kind of do it to, you know, to sequence and figure out everything for all your mutations.
She sequenced enough mutations that it became clear that there was a pattern in the in their location. The pattern was that these destabilizing mutations exclusively occurred at places in the protein that were either buried or rigid in the structure. And that meant you could think about any protein crystal structure and or in terms of, well, the important stuff is buried and rigid,
mm-hmm.
and the stuff that's not important for the structure is outside or floppy. And it was really a simplifying concept that was absolutely generally applicable and, really related to this issue or opposed this issue, this view of proteins as just being collections of different interactions that all made the same contribution. You know, it was saying a hydrogen bond inside is different from a hydrogen bond outside.
Okay.
You know? And either this had to do with the fact that interactions on the inside were by definition exchanged when the protein folded, that is, in the folded protein, the partners were always different mm-hmm. because they were other protein atoms, and the ones on the outside still could interact with solvent in the folded structure, and those interactions
and
with solvent might be similar in the unfolded structure.
Or different. They didn't.
Yeah, or but at least equivalent. Or that there was something special about atoms that were constrained by the framework to interact, mm-hmm. held in a favorable mm-hmm. position. And so that result that rigid parts were important. It fit very well with this idea that model systems aren't the whole story, and also
or that there's another model, maybe.
Well, it also suggested how.
Okay, that wasn't modeled that same way. That one
yeah,
was. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
How it suggested why some
models
interactions are different from others.
That perhaps these model all the other models. Well, okay, models. Building as it has been had been done was kind of two dimensional, and here was this. And I'm not talking about structures, really. I'm not talking, you know. I'm just saying in a sense of complexity. And here was something three dimensional because it took into consideration, you know, a third sort of variable or something like that.
Well, you know, if you really look at the data on model systems thoroughly, the conclusion that models lack something, the assumption that all interactions are the same, that's inherent in models, that it's not applicable even to models. It's there in the data on model systems. So, for example, different solvent transfer experiments for measuring hydrophobicity come up with different scales. And so instead of saying that scales don't apply to proteins because we don't know what kind of environment
right.
Side chains are being transferred into, the debate was, and still is, which scale is appropriate. Right. Excuse me.
Yeah.
So
okay,
another example is the field of hydrogen bonds. So studies on N-methylacetamide were done in the 60s and interpreted to in such a way that suggested that hydrogen bonds don't contribute to protein stability. On the other hand, when we did experiments with proteins and eliminated hydrogen bonding groups, we changed stability. So there was some kind of contradiction there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you just looked at the data on other model systems, so Shellman's work in the 50s on urea
mm-hmm.
suggested that, in fact, hydrogen bonds might contribute to the stability of the urea dimer, even in water. And Bill Jenks wrote a review of different hydrogen bonding systems that suggested that the more constrained hydrogen bonding groups are to interact favorably, the more likely.
And it was just ignored then.
The more likely
the
bond is.
It was kind of like in the past when someone finally came up with this model system about hydrogen bonding's participation being minimal, you know, that was...
Yeah.
That was, had been left by the wayside because, of course, it didn't fit into the construction of the model.
It didn't fit with sort of what was in the textbooks and what everybody thought and what everybody was taught. And then if you really challenge people, you know, they say, oh, well,
this is
the model systems are first order. You know, you're talking about second order perturbations or these special technical words.
You're
you
talking
know.
About proteins folding and unfolding. Yeah. You know, whether it's a kick in the butt or a kick to the direct to the head, right? I mean, if it changes it.
So anyway, the review was really about the issue of how do model systems relate to protein folding, and part of the impetus for it, or part of the inspiration for it, was this result that rigid varied parts are important, and also Creighton had written a paper in 1984 suggesting how different interactions of a given type
is
might
this
make
the thing that he called
the
cooperativity thing.
Yeah, exactly. Effective concentration. Yeah.
If I can ask this, you know, I have a whole slew of questions, but I guess first to just say that this is a great starting off point, your review article, for anybody who ever wishes to start making history, whole history out of this area of biology. I think, you know, you've got some references in here that may end up falling by the wayside. You know, I think this is... And I certainly found that there's a story that people's names keep showing up here and there and everywhere and mix and change just the footnotes. If you follow the footnotes, you could start constructing a kind of a stage, and we're going to run out of tape.